Good afternoon. The Education and Employment Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Latvala.
Here.
Vice Chair McLean.
Here.
Committee Whip Andrade.
Here.
Ranking Member Williams.
Here.
Representative Lupus.
Here.
Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Barrera.
Here.
Representative Bush.
Here.
Representative Fine.
Here.
Representative Harding.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Punchowski.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Morales.
Here.
Representative Trabulski.
Here.
Representative Tuck. Representative Valdez.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Members, please remember to silence all electronic devices. Be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. And remember to push the microphone button after you have been recognized, as the green light on the microphone no longer represents a live mic. Good afternoon, members. Welcome to the Education and Employment Committee. Normally at our first committee meeting, we would take time at the beginning to introduce ourselves. However, since our time is limited, I'd like to get straight to work and begin discussing some important issues that will come up this session. If time permits, we will take time at the end of the meeting to move through member introductions. We're looking forward to the discussions, debate, and policy solutions that will be offered this year by Chair Lupus and members on the subcommittee on early learning and elementary education, and also Chair McLean's and the members on the subcommittee on secondary education and career development, as well as Chair Mariano and the members on the subcommittee on post-secondary education and lifelong learning. In the years that I have served in the Florida House, this is the first time education and employment have been in the same policy area. The Speaker and I had numerous conversations around the goal of the committee structure, and it is pretty simple and clear: to create an integrated education and workforce system. For today's meeting, we are focusing on workforce and education. As we already know, COVID-19 accelerated the disruptions our workforce was already experiencing. Jobs will be created and eliminated at an accelerated rate, and existing roles will be redefined, requiring a shift in training to develop the skills needed by employers. State education and workforce systems lack critical alignment with the evolving needs of industry. We must build a statewide integration system so every worker can participate in the workforce. Through meetings at the subcommittee and committee level, we will unpack the challenges facing our education and workforce systems and look for opportunity to create policy to address those challenges. Today, we have two presentations and discussions about the need for comprehensive coordinated workforce and education systems that respond to the rapidly changing needs of the workforce. Our first presenters are Dr. Melanie Zaber and Lynn Caroli with RAND Corporation. Dr. Zaber and Caroli are authors of the research Reimagining the Workforce Development System for the 21st Century and Beyond. Dr. Zaber will provide us with an overview of the problems facing workforce development and employment systems, as well as desired features of an integrated system. And then Dr. Caroli will join us to answer any questions you may have. Dr. Zaber, you are recognized.
Thank you very much. Let me just pull up the presentation. Chairman Latvala, Ranking Member Williams, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to present on how the integration of education, workforce development, and employment systems can improve outcomes for workers, students, and firms. The views Dr. Carolee and I share today are largely based on a peer-reviewed report published by the RAND Corporation as part of an internally funded effort to reimagine the workforce development and employment system to better meet 21st century needs. In December of 2019, shortly before the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and accompanying recession, 72% of Americans with a four-year post-secondary degree and 63% of Americans with an associate's degree were employed. In contrast, just 45% of those who had not completed high school were employed. Simultaneously, firms reported being unable to find workers for open positions, due partly to skill shortages and partly to changes in the amenities that a job offers. Now, the number of open positions has been decimated by the pandemic recession. Many businesses have closed permanently. One estimate placed the total at 420,000 nationwide as of July 2020. And of the businesses that remain, some are replacing full-time employees with temporary contract workers to save money and increase agility. These forces are acting on a system that was already insufficient to support American workers and employers. In spite of demographic shifts, technological advancement, and globalization transforming how people work, the linear pipeline approach to workforce preparation in the United States looks very much the same as it did several decades ago. Our fragmented system does not readily support the reality of today's career paths. Rather than staying in one field with one skill set for an entire working career, today's workers may need to reskill as labor market needs evolve, requiring many highly accessible on-ramps to the education and training system. In this presentation, we'll discuss first the workforce development and employment system as it exists now, in contrast to an idealized system, then how an integrated system can better support students, workers, and firms, and finally, how some U.S. states are approaching this issue. In Figure 1 on your screen, we illustrate a simplified version of the pipeline for the current workforce development and employment system. It begins with individuals in the top half of the figure, and they make decisions about education and training, represented in the green boxes, and employment, represented in this gold box. Their education and training experiences affect their acquisition of what economists would call human capital, and that's represented by these blue arrows leading to the blue box. Human capital consists of the knowledge, skills, and competencies that individuals develop, some of which might be very general, and some of which could be specific to a given occupation, function, or even a job. These elements of human capital are often formalized and documented in certificates, credentials, and degrees. Individuals then take this human capital into the labor market, represented by these blue arrows, choosing to participate if they find a job that they prefer to being unemployed or out of the labor force. Now, that decision is going to be affected by their family context, their health and disability status, and other personal factors. But note that these arrows up above flow only in one direction. Because the current pipeline-style system presumes that education is complete once someone enters the workforce, post-secondary education students who already have significant labor market experience are characterized as non-traditional due to their relative rarity. In contrast, this figure 2 depicts our idealized system. Here, the education and training choices extend throughout one's working career, allowing individuals to freely move between employment and education, sometimes combining the two in apprenticeships, co-ops, and other job-based learning. Workers can also choose to only partially retire, pursuing a reduced scope role, or potentially engaging in encore entrepreneurship. Some might also unretire, finding that they would like to continue to use their skills in the labor market for personal or financial reasons. But in both models, these decisions aren't happening in a vacuum. Individuals are reacting to information about current economic conditions, and they're both constrained and supported by policy at the local, state, and federal levels. In addition to individuals, there are several other key stakeholder groups that you see represented here in orange. First, education and training institutions. These consist of public or private providers of education and training across the spectrum. That includes early learning, K-12 schooling, higher education, and vocational training. And these groups are going to make decisions about learning objectives, curricula, and pedagogy, as well as the features of their programs that affect cost, quality, and learning outcomes. Next, we have employers or firms. Representing different industries, employers make decisions about what goods and services to produce, how many workers to hire, and into which roles in order to achieve those outputs. They also make choices about the nature of the work environment, the structure of compensation, and how much to invest in further developing the skills and competencies of those they employ. Next, we have unions and other worker organizations like guilds. These organizations act as intermediaries between firms and workers and help negotiate compensation and working conditions. In some sectors that have non-traditional employment arrangements, like construction or the arts, these trade unions and guilds provide access to continuous benefits like health insurance, opportunities for skill advancement through apprenticeships, and other workforce-related services. Finally, we'll characterize labor market intermediaries and social services together. Social welfare programs like food assistance or unemployment offices and local workforce investment boards like CareerSource Florida that you have here provide targeted job search services and job training supports for individuals and for the workforce more generally. Now, in our idealized model, these stakeholder groups are sharing information in real time. There's clear information flows between and among them. The system features strong connectivity, flexibility, and responsiveness, as well as multiple on-ramps to education, training, and employment for displaced and transitioning workers. An ideal system would also feature aligned incentives, data-driven decision-making, and open dissemination of new evidence. But in many communities, stakeholder groups act more as independent silos. We'll next discuss three examples of the challenges facing today's students, workers, and firms, and how system connectedness and disconnectedness influences the paths they can take. So our first example discusses how sectoral investment in a region can create new skill needs. As industries evolve and employers relocate, a region might find a skill set in high demand with low supply. For example, the construction of a $6 billion ethane cracker plant in the Pittsburgh region was expected to bring almost 400,000 jobs to the area, including middle-skill jobs in petrochemical processing and advanced manufacturing. Using an initial grant from the U.S. Department of Labor, a group of employers, community colleges, employment centers, and industry associations formed a sustainable partnership to establish clear career pathways for the new jobs. The partner community colleges still provide an industry-aligned system of stackable credentials, which allow a worker to take a single course at one college, build that up to a certificate at another college, and add additional courses to obtain an associate's or bachelor's degree, all while working in the industry. Our second example focuses on how data can inform decision-making. The integration of data across system stakeholders can better support decision-making. Combining education and employment data in a statewide longitudinal data system facilitates analysis of the performance of educational sectors, institutions, and even individual programs. Having a fully developed statewide system allows states to easily share metrics with prospective students and transitioning workers. Now, Florida was a pioneer in this area. The Florida Department of Education has already integrated K-12, post-secondary, technical education, and workforce data. The Launch My Career web portal gives users access to much of this information, showing them data on the average wages and employment rates of some programs' graduates. But this portal could be made even more useful to prospective students and workers by making program completion rates and statistics by demographic subgroup readily available. This missing dimension might make it harder for prospective students from underrepresented groups to see themselves within available averages, given the known variation by race, gender, and ethnicity in who completes education pathways, who's hired into an occupation, and how much workers are paid. Our final example focuses on paying for post-secondary education. States can financially incentivize students and institutions to align on high-demand skill pathways. So Michigan funds the Talent for Tomorrow Scholarship to assist low-income residents with the cost of obtaining a degree or credential in growing fields. Utah has a similar program that they call the Talent Development Incentive Loan Program. These programs can support individuals in pursuing relevant training where relevance is determined by current data, and encourage employers to remain in states with promising talent pools, all while helping education and training institutions develop and fill high-demand programs. In light of these challenges and opportunities, states have begun to modify their governance systems and oversight structures to improve their flexibility, responsiveness, and information flows, among other objectives. The 2014 Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, also known as WIOA, encouraged state workforce boards to bring together all relevant stakeholders like employers, public sector agencies, educational institutions, and community nonprofit organizations for partnership and collaboration. And some state legislatures have gone even beyond this provision, adapting various strategies for further integrating their workforce development and employment systems. One approach has been to combine two or more state agencies, like Missouri's Department of Higher Education and Workforce Development, which united the Division of Workforce Development, the Economic Research and Information Center, and the Department of Higher Education, all under a single office. Another strategy has been the creation of a new cross-cutting entity, like the Mississippi Office of Workforce Development and the Indiana Governor's Workforce Cabinet. In addition to integrating labor and education agencies, some states have aimed to foster collaboration with other departments that serve special populations, like those receiving aid from the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, youth involved with the juvenile justice system, or individuals with work-limiting disabilities. For example, Vermont's State Workforce Development Board is tasked with collaborating with the State Department of Labor, as well as other agencies focusing on commerce and community development, education, human services, agriculture, natural resources, and transportation. Because these models are relatively new, they provide a view of potential options rather than a proven blueprint for reimagining state governance. By better integrating stakeholders and institutions across education and labor systems, states can enhance their ability to support workers across their many career and educational transitions. This integration and close collaboration enhance the system's ability to provide stability, flexibility, and growth for all involved. Lynn and I are looking forward to discussing this in more detail with your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Members, are there any questions? Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Chair LaValla. And I don't know if this will be the appropriate time to ask the question or if we should wait for the other presenter. But my question is, and again, if they want to answer it later, it's fine. Where is the equity lens in this conversation for students?
Do y'all want to try to tackle that one, Dr. Caroli or Dr. Zaber?
Happy to do so. So I think the equity lens is a really important one, especially as we talk about individuals transitioning through the workforce and the education system because of the known disparities in access to and outcomes within both of these systems. This is an area where data can be very helpful to identify some of these disparities and areas where improvements can be made. In particular, that's why one of the elements I highlighted in the discussion of longitudinal data systems is really to not just make averages available, but also make statistics by subgroup available. We know that there are certain occupations where it is very challenging for individuals from underrepresented backgrounds to gain purchase into that occupation. And so, having statistics that reflect what the reality will be for all individuals can be really informative for those making career and educational decisions. That said, obviously, these statistics can also help identify these structural barriers, identify where there's more work to be done at a policy level, not just individual decision-making. Dr. Caroli, you want to add?
Yeah, I think I'd just add again that this is a great example where taking an integrated cross-cutting approach, one that brings together, whether state level or local level, different agencies, different sectors, different stakeholders, can also help address the various barriers that may lead to the disparities that we see. So that rather than being siloed within one part of the system, you have an opportunity to look system-wide and look at the ways in which different types of features of the system may be presenting barriers that could be addressed through policy.
Do you have a follow-up? Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow-up question is, and maybe I'm jumping the gun, if you will, but what would that data collection look like if we were to, at the end of session, pass something that will direct the department or to initiate? What would that data collection look like and how long will it take? Because considering the whole state, I mean, it's a lot of data, right? And then going down into its own communities within the state. So what would that look like and what's the time frame?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Valdez. I can't say what the timeline would be in Florida, but I will say Florida is ahead of many states in data collection efforts. So the system that Florida has already integrates that K-12 and post-secondary and workforce data. What I was presenting and discussing is the idea of changing what gets shared publicly. And so right now, there are statistics on average outcomes, but not incorporating the demographic data that are already, I would expect, in the databases, since K-12 institutions do collect demographic data, already in the database. It's just not presented and analyzed by that element. So it depends on who does the analysis for your Launch My Career portals, but that agency could use the existing data to make those statistics available. Now, obviously, privacy of students and workers is a really important consideration whenever you start slicing data by narrower dimensions. And so one would have to be very careful to ensure that, that privacy is maintained and that no individuals are identifiable through the information that's shared.
I think I would just add that, if it's possible, briefly, that an important aspect is not only having the data, but also using it. So a commitment, for example, to a periodic report that provides a shorter tracking of particular metrics that are of interest to you all as policymakers, but to other stakeholders in the state, would be a goal to work toward, identifying what those metrics are, how often they should be reported, and a commitment to making that information publicly available so you can look at a point in time and progress over time.
Thank you.
And one comment to add to, I'm sorry, Chair.
No, you can go ahead.
I understand that Florida already has undergone an audit of the CTE programs within the state. That kind of audit approach is a way that one could look at those metrics that Dr. Carley is describing.
Thank you. Whip Andrade, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Your Pittsburgh example in particular sounds a whole lot like what Florida's economic development programs have done for a long time, and the QRT, the quick response training that's offered, you know, to entice companies to come to a specific region and train up future employees in that area. I guess the big difference is institutionalizing it. And do you have any advice for us if we do start to really determine what jobs are guaranteed to have a need, looking out 4 years or 8 years in advance, what would be some of your metrics for us to try and make sure that we're getting the best return on our investment if we're going to start institutionalizing these programs?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. One of the unique aspects of the Pittsburgh approach was not just the availability of the training, but the system of stackable credentials that they built up. And the idea behind that was to really create the sustainability of career paths for individuals and for the industry as it grows. And so instead of just being trained for a given job, they were given almost a menu of, you know, you've got this existing credential and that qualifies you for this job and you can continue to work. And as you gain on the job experience, that lets you move on to this next rung of the career path. But if you chose to acquire some other credential, that allows you to move, you know, laterally in the career lattice. And so it was really creating almost an ecosystem of credentials and jobs within that industry that really was designed for long-term growth. So if you are able to identify those areas for long-term growth, I would encourage, based on how successful the Pittsburgh program was, that actually Rand has done a report evaluating, that suggests that these kind of more sustainable, more long-view programs create longer-term partnerships between both individuals, education and training institutions, and the employers in the region.
Thank you.
I'll just add that you also asked about metrics. If I could just add that I think with the kind of data systems that we're talking about, being able to look at enrollment in the types of programs that Melanie referred to would be metrics you could look to, but also placement in positions, and then look at wage advancement over time, because the expectation would be much of the economic return would show up in more productive, higher-paid workers, and then an increase in the size of the local economy.
Thank you. Members, any other questions on this portion? All right, seeing none. Next, it is good to know that Florida isn't the only state working to do a better job connecting education and workforce. It's also good to connect research and practice. For our next presentation, we will hear from Nick Moore. Mr. Moore serves as the Education Policy Advisor and Coordinator in the Alabama Governor's Office of Education and Workforce Transformation and has been instrumental as Alabama has worked to integrate these systems for the last few years. Mr. Moore, you are recognized.
Thank you kindly, Chairman Latvala, Vice Chair McClain, Whip Andrade, and Ranking Member Williams, and fellow members of the committee. It is a pleasure to join you on behalf of Governor Kay Ivey, and it's always good to be talking to folks from a fellow state that are also what I would consider fellow travelers on the work of increasing the talent development and human capital potential of our states. And so what I'd like to do with you today is share a little bit about what Governor Ivey and our legislature have been working on since 2018 to develop a competency-based, data-driven, and demand-driven talent and human capital development ecosystem in the state. I will start by saying that it all centered around the governor's leadership, which is absolutely essential in connecting education, workforce training, and economic development. And I appreciate the first presentation from the RAND Corporation, which made the astute point that the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, or WIOA, that was reauthorized in 2014, and the Every Student Succeeds Act and the Carl D. Perkins Act, taken together, form the basis for an aligned education to workforce ecosystem, or as Governor Ivey calls it, a P20 system. But it only provides about 80% of the alignment. The state and the governor has to put the rest of that together. And so I will get into a couple of specific points as we go forward. But beyond strong leadership from the governor and the legislature, setting big goals is important. And so many states that have been partnering with the Lumina Foundation have set attainment goals. We set an attainment goal to have 500,000 additional Alabamians credentialed by 2025. And this strategy is focused on equity and human capital development. One of the members asked the question about equity, so I'd like to focus on that first, because that is at the center of our talent development strategic plan. And it really does not do enough just to pay lip service to this. It must be an indelible part of the state's plan, beginning with the WIOA combined plan. So, for example, in Alabama 2020 state combined WIOA plan, the governor put specific criteria. Was given a certain percentage of our overall attainment goal and also our state's labor force participation goal. I'm sorry if I dropped off there for a second. I think my connection was unstable, but I should be back with you now. And so what that allowed us to do was take our 500,000 goal for attainment and also labor force participation, because Alabama, like many other southeastern states, suffers from an historically low level of labor force participation. What I mean by that are the individuals between 16 and 64 that are working or actively looking for work. And sometimes when we only look at the unemployment rate, we do not take into account that there's many people on the sidelines that are not participating, and they're facing pretty steep benefit cliff to where their short-term interest may not be aligned with their long-term interest, because the rug, and to put it in a colloquial terms, is getting pulled out from under them as they transition into paid employment. So they might be losing TANF, SNAP, Medicaid, child care subsidy, and the rate at which they are in, are gaining wages through paid employment is not making up for that difference in a quick enough period of time. So our strategy is to braid and blend together the 105-plus federal and state-funded workforce and education programs to provide a bridge and transition for the 41.5% of Alabamians that were not participating in the labor force in February, and also for the 927,000 Alabamians that have filed an initial unemployment claim since March. And so that's two very acute populations with extreme need. Also, we have to take into account that we're continuing our quest to connect education and the economy, connect academic and technical career pathways through secondary and post-secondary CTE, and eliminating some of the rightful stigma around tracking that has existed in these programs, and to demonstrate through experience and by showing to our citizens that what we're doing is showing that academic and technical skills are complementary and are not mutually exclusive. And so to begin this work, we had to lay down a new foundation. It's real easy to say that we're going to align programs to in-demand jobs. What we found is that you ask each group and they have a different list of in-demand jobs. Plus, there's lots of people in the private sector that are happy to tell you what all your in-demand jobs are. And there's nothing wrong with that, but what we wanted to do is look at our primary labor market information and figure out for ourselves what are our list of in-demand jobs, and do that by using a sector strategy approach and then bringing in members of business and industry, education, economic developers. But we codified this in the 2019 session into a public-private entity called the ACCCP, or the Alabama Committee on Credentialing and Career Pathways. Its job is to come up with our list of regional and statewide in-demand jobs so that everybody is using the same list. All of our state agencies all know what the same list of in-demand jobs are. And then also to develop our compendium of valuable credentials, which are all of the credentials that are linked to competencies that denote mastery of those competencies. So we're trying to develop the occupational DNA for a job. And so when we're talking to education and training providers and we say, well, you need to be more responsive to industry, that's really hard to do if there's not the infrastructure for translating the competencies and credentials and skills that an employer needs to see into a job or in a job, and then translate that into a training program. And then what's more, to try to do that in a way that allows somebody to move from an entry level to an opportunity to a destination occupation. So that is the goal for the ACCCP. Now, another thing that's important is that we're using an empirical and scalable and replicable process for coming up with our in-demand jobs each year. So we come up with regional lists using these criteria from our five-star rubric. And so I won't enumerate all these because you can take a look at them, but there's five criteria. You have to have those first three, and then it either has to have criteria four or five. And this takes into account some jobs that do not lead to a credential of value, but are providing a family-sustaining wage or part of a career pathway to where the entry-level job might not produce a family-sustaining wage, but is a part of a career pathway that then leads to a family-sustaining wage. So the idea here is that we want to make sure people are on the trajectory to be self-sufficient. And so jobs that are on three or more of our seven regional lists get put on the statewide list of in-demand jobs. And then we use something called the Alabama Occupational Ontology, and these numbers are a little small here. But you can see at the top that there's an alphanumeric number at the top that represents a code for a particular competency. And then at the bottom, each of those competencies are coded to a particular credential. And so, for example, on our skills-based job description generator, an employer can go on there from a drop-down list, choose the credentials and the skills that represent the job that they're trying to fill. They post that on our learning and employment record, or, you know, different groups call them different things, interoperable learning record, basically a dashboard that's a verified digital resume so that an individual student or job seeker can list all of the credentials in a verified way, and then they can get geofenced or sort of captured and matched to that skills-based job description. If they're looking for a job, they would then be matched with the employer. This reduces costs for HR costs for employers. It reduces the amount of time that it takes to wade through a stack of 800 resumes. And for Alabamians and, you know, people anywhere that are trying to transition into self-sufficiency on the back of a very difficult year, and in many cases, intergenerational poverty for some families, they need to have as transparent a pathway as possible. And so to know how to modularize a degree, and to some of the points that were made in the previous presentation, how to articulate the credit value for a non-degree experience, a short-term workforce program, or any industry-recognized credential, and then know in a pretty almost encyclopedic way what is the credit value that can then be articulated for a long-term certificate or a degree program. In Alabama, and, you know, for many states that to where there is a large percentage of folks that are living in poverty, or also any of those barriers that I showed, and also for states that have a large number of groups that are first-generation students, often are overrepresented in the number of non-degree credentials that are earned. And so, for example, in Alabama, we are seeing a vast majority, you know, our plurality, 37% of our non-degree certificates are being earned by minority students. Now, what we want to do is make sure that we are connecting those non-degree experiences to traditional 2- and 4-year degrees, because we know, as Dr. Carnevale has shown with the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, we don't need to sell anybody a wooden nickel, and particularly those that it's their first time in post-secondary education. We have to make sure that that provides long-term value in the labor market. So it's not enough just to give somebody a credential and get them into a job. We also have to make sure that that is providing long-term post-secondary value, and that folks are able to have on-ramps and off-ramps into and out of the workforce so that they can choose the pathway that works for them and to be the master of their own destiny in that regard. And so also we recognize that not all credentials are equal, and so we needed to have some quality assurance criteria that we developed with the National Skills Coalition. And again, so I won't enumerate all of these, but when a credential is registered to the Alabama Credential Registry, it's evaluated against all 10 of these criteria. And if it doesn't meet one of those, then it has to be waived by one of our technical advisory committees. So that's the, you know, you could call it a committee, but it's really a sector strategy that represents the industry that that credential represents. Now, sometimes there's dual jurisdiction because it's covering more than one industry, but the TACs are appointed by members of business and industry by the governor, and they represent one of the 7 workforce regions in the state. So we're trying to get a wide berth of coverage for the industry and then also geographically. And so I mentioned our credential registry, but it's important that we have both the credential registry so we can make credentials transparent and really to have a big encyclopedia. Right now we're in the wild west of credentials. There's over 7,000 non-degree industry recognized credentials offered. Some are great, some provide almost no labor market value. And so it is very important that we have a way for not only making them transparent through our registry, but then back to this about the quality assurance process. So what that does is allows us to then populate the competency models I described. And this is all then validated by industry. So when a training provider or an employer or anybody's looking at this, they understand that this is not just been cooked up by someone in an IHE or somebody that's making a training program, but it's been validated by the demands of industry. And so another important part of our model is a 2-pronged career pathway model. You'll see at the top left-hand corner, we're combining secondary CTE through Perkins funds with post-secondary CTE, and we owe a Title I in-school youth funds and Title IV rehabilitative service funds to provide a seamless post-secondary and secondary program of study that meets the needs of youth so that they can progress more rapidly through this program of study, even complete an in-school youth apprenticeship. So, for example, we've gotten a waiver through USDOL to allow for in-school youth ITAs to provide for apprenticeship opportunities, and then also potentially complete an associate degree in high school. But students also have to have a life. So we're looking at ways, for example, like in computer science, to where a student can get the computer science and a math or science credit concurrently. So if we want everybody to do an apprenticeship and get an associate degree, they may want to be in the band or, you know, have a boyfriend or girlfriend. So we got to think about these qualitative things too as we go. And then at the bottom left-hand corner, you'll see how we're combining adult basic education and CTE and WIOA funds to provide the same program of study and career pathway to adults through concurrent enrollment in adult education and CTE. But we're elongating their pathway because we know that adults have much more dynamic family responsibilities, and they really need, in some cases, to get a credential, get a raise, get that next job, and then at their own pace, go back and get the next credential in the sequence. So this allows us to unbundle degrees, and it also allows us to take into account that, you know, we really have to democratize the modalities of learning. We've done a great job in the country expanding access to financial aid through the Higher Education Act, but some of it is due to technology and some of it is just due to resistance. We have not done as much on democratizing the modalities of delivering education by unbundling degrees, by breaking these degrees down into four or five segments to where you can, as we, everyone here has discussed, earn a credential and then cash that in for a degree. And then also, you know, asynchronous, self-paced learning, employer-sponsored training, and then credit for prior learning. And so all of the different ways that, folks are learning in a more on-demand 21st century learning and employment ecosystem have to be validated, and they have to be become indelible parts of our training and employment ecosystem if we're going to meet the demands of diverse learners and increase our labor force participation rate. I will close on mentioning that we are developing a longitudinal data system that will launch in June that connects all of our workforce and education data and produces longitudinal reports that informs the governor on making adjustments into everything from programs that are producing, not producing, but also to try to get a better ROI long-term on programs so that the left hand knows what the right hand's doing, that we know dynamically what the outcome is on a first-class pre-K program, for example. And then returning that data back to the people of Alabama through the tool that I mentioned once, our Alabama College and Career Exploration tool, that's our learning and employment record. It's a digital resume connects to the WIOA integrated case management system so that we understand how to produce a no wrong door approach to the workforce system so that clients are not having to go to multiple locations as they enter into our public workforce system. And a lot of this, and I should have mentioned this at the top, but I will stop here and say that this, the governor set my office up by braiding together Perkins State Leadership Funds and also WIOA Governor's 15% set-aside funds and to coordinate a lot of this work. And so there's a lot of silos, a lot of people doing good work, but it's kind of like an orchestra to where if everybody's just trying to do some jazz improv, you know, that doesn't work with a symphony orchestra. So you've got to have everybody generally working from the same sheet of music. And so that's where a lot of the rallying around some of the big goals, and then to have you know, a group in the state that is not with a stick but with a carrot and with excitement around the vision, keeping everybody working towards progress on these big goals. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know I have outstripped my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore, for your presentation. Members, are there any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you all very much for your time today and your presentations. Thank you. Members, we have about 15 minutes left, which I am not sure will be enough time to introduce everybody. And I know that we have some members on both sides of the aisle that are a bit long-winded, like Chairman Alupis, and I know that we have at least one preacher on the committee. And it's also freezing in here. So I'm going to skip that portion, but I do want to introduce our staff. Our administrative assistant is Missy Jones. Miss Jones has been with the House for almost 30 years, and she will be a great resource for you and your staff. She started working in the House when she was 8 years old. And our staff director is Miss Joanna Hassel. She's served in this capacity for the last 4 years, and she is also wonderful. Joanna will be a great resource for you all as well, so please do not hesitate to call on either one of them. And I wanted to introduce Vice Chair McClain. Do you have anything that you want to add now that you're put on the spot? Okay. Ranking Member Williams, is there anything you want to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just look forward to, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to working toward a new workforce development and employment system. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Whip Andrade, you're now on the spot. Would you like, is there anything you'd like to add?
I was going to make a lower Alabama resident joke based on the last presentation, but in the interest of time, I'll save it.
All righty. Is there any other questions, comments, or concerns before the committee? All right, seeing none, Vice Chair McLean moves that we rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned.